So, if anybody wants to share some of the highlights of their discussions or one of the things that we could bring up for continue to explore a bit further or bounce off us. Yeah.
At first, it seemed that we each had our own take or our own experience. One person was well employed, another was looking at retirement, another it was about how to deal with employees, and yet another person it was how to make personal choices. And but what was neat is as we spoke, looking for commonality, it started to become a conversation about objects in mind and how we need them.
Yeah.
And that was really pleasing.
Yeah. And then those underlying principles that you can come back to, and you realize that those principles are actually applicable in so those principles are applicable in so many different situations, and will serve one well, sort of in the world. Great, very good.
Question that I brought up that we've been focusing on, like, what is right and what is wrong in like pretty broad terms, killing, not killing, things like that. And something that is a question that came up for you earlier in the day, and that is, as far as right livelihood, how does it affect us? How we're affecting others by our actions, but how whatever livelihood we're in, how it affects us, hence working in a job that is not fulfilling whatsoever.
Wow.
It's just to get a paycheck. To me, that's doing one a disservice.
Yeah, so
when,
yeah.
If there are options, other options available, sometimes we do have to take the job that's available and what have you. But, I just see it in a lot of people that are in that 9-to-5 grind. Some people thrive on that and they do well, but some people don't.
Yeah.
And a lot of anxiety, depression, other unwholesome mind states seem to develop out of that kind of abstract area of the way I was looking at right life.
Right. Yeah, because I think that, even something that, right livelihood, if you look at it on paper, it might be, right livelihood, but it's just making it totally miserable. one still has to look at it in terms of the effect on oneself. How to be able to adjust, one's life, what choices one has, what trade-offs are there. Also, it's always helpful to remember that the really doesn't matter what situation one is in. There's always going to be benefits and drawbacks. It doesn't take too long to see the there isn't any way of living in the world in the human condition on the conventional realm of having a mind and a body and have only absolute benefits and everything goes well. Good. Everything is just glowingly good all the time. it just isn't like that. So that benefits, and so one has to be able to reflect on that. What are the benefits? What are the drawbacks? How to work with that? When does something tip into an area where there's just too many drawbacks, too many. Too problematic in nature to deal with, and best to to try to do something else. So those are good reflections to be considering.
We discussed a little bit that Buddha telling you what not to do, but not telling us what we should be doing now. Mm-hmm. It is sometimes because you could have, but I live with that is not harmful to anybody in any way, and is very fulfilling personally on a personal level. But at the end of the day, it's not really a real contribution to the world in any way. It's just something mm-hmm. to keep thinking.
And
how unbalanced that is in a way.
Well, I think one of the in terms of the because there's various criteria and guidelines that the Buddha gives, and certainly the aspects those increase of wholesome dhammas and finding and then in one's livelihood, both being able to benefit oneself, one's immediate family dependents, or society in general, so that and that's actually one of the things that is kind of a bottom line that in the Buddha's guidance, when one thinks of benefits and what is beneficial, it's never measured just beneficial for oneself. It's always together with for oneself and for others. So those are a criterion that we can be considering. And but then one of the problems that comes up for especially people in Western cultures is it's almost invariably taken to kind of a rational ideal of what one should and shouldn't do, and it tends to be idealized so easily, and then we compare ourselves with others, and then tend to beat ourselves up, and it's a wonderfully kind of Western approach, how to make ourselves more neurotic and and miserable. Just doing something ordinary, like going to a job. So it's there is that element.
Well, first of all, I appreciate that we have the chance to talk amongst ourselves, because it's really interesting to hear what other people have said about their jobs. One thing I noticed about our group was everybody in our group had or is trying to kind of struggle with different issues around livelihood. This way or that way. It's like nobody in our group said, "I got it dialed in. I'm in tune."
Yeah.
We're all kind of still working that dial, trying to get it in tune.
Right.
You know, maybe some of that is what you're saying. It's like this, we have this idealized notion that there is the thing. Yeah. But I would imagine on some level, too, I mean, there's the implication that by right livelihood, it is possible to get into. So I'm just curious to know if anybody here is willing. we're all still, like, I'm not saying anybody's perfect, you know, but I'm just curious if anybody feels like more or less, like, you know, I pretty much feel solid, you know, got it more or less worked out.
Well, I'll just make a comment a little.
Yeah.
Like, I also feel that, like Ajahn Passa was saying, this is an incredible Western kind of way of approaching things. Like, there's, you have to look at your own character, and this tendency for so many of us is to look at things and, like, just focus on the negative, you know? Like, you look at your situation, you kind of look at all the ways in which it's not the right livelihood. And like, I to me, it's significant. Like, okay, the Buddha, the five things that he kind of points out as being wrong livelihood, they're pretty extreme, you know? Like, selling weapons. Like, that's... Now, I think of that... Like, I think the way it's described, it's almost like, okay, selling weapons, being the person who's kind of... who's making the profit, who's kind of got, like, the owner of the weapons company, you know? Like, that's the guy who's really, really doing the wrong livelihood. And everyone else is kind of, well, it's up to you to what extent you want to, you know, change your livelihood or not. But, like, that one extreme is, like, okay, that's the wrong livelihood. Everything else is just shades of not quite right. And so what is in tune at the end of the day is, like, to what extent can you be at peace? Like, can you come back, meditate, and let go and just basically accept, you know that's where this whole thing is resolved. It's not through finding the right livelihood. It's through being good enough to the point where you can, you know, let go and be at peace with it.
Also, that right livelihood is only... it's one of the factors that harmonizes with the other factors.
Exactly.
And so long as it doesn't it isn't such horrible karma that one is intrinsically creating real problems for oneself. I'm almost 40 years as a monk now, and especially in the West, I mean, I haven't met any arms dealers yet.
I met this doctor once, and this former doctor, and and he was saying that he couldn't deal with the fact that he might, or he struggled with the fact that he might, like, go into surgery and, like, save somebody's life. And then they might go out and kill somebody. What can you do? I mean, you know, if that's you're going to take that extreme, you may as well be a Jain, you know.
Yeah,
maybe be a better phrase, right enough likelihood.
Yeah. And there's, I mean, I think of, because most people do have, you know, livelihoods that are, it's always going to be a bit, there's always going to be conundrums and problems around that. And I'm thinking of, that comes to mind as a, I gave the example when we were doing the planning, as a person who I know who is a, he's a career police officer, very well educated. He's from a very wealthy family, and actually made a choice to become a police officer. And he focused in on community policing. That was his area. He did master's or PhD thesis on community policing, and then is focusing on community policing, so that because he went into it with his eyes open. This is in Thailand. And police in Thailand there's an idiom in Thai language. You see, if you're the wife of a military officer, you'll count bottles. If you're the wife of a police officer, you'll count dollar bills. No, I mean, ใช่ไหม เป็นเมียทหารก็นับขวด เป็นเมียตำรวจนับแบงค์
You might have to explain what that actually means.
Yeah, well, sort of, if you're married into a military officer, you're going to be counting empty bottles because he's drinking a lot, and that's what you're going to do. If you're married into a police officer, you're going to be counting, dollar bills because you're going to get lots of money because of they're on the take all the time. They're on the take. So anyway, this guy is very committed to right livelihood. He's also heads up a very large meditation center in Bangkok. His wife and his children regularly do retreats through the every year they do retreats together, and then they do retreats separately. So he goes into it with understanding the difficulties, and has chosen an area that he feels that he could make an impact, a positive impact in the society. And then, he's bright, upright person, so then a senior police general wants to help him out, and it looks like he's not making a whole lot of money, so he gives him a big transfer into the drug unit, which you make big money there. And I arrived in Thailand, and he'd just got this promotion, and he was really distraught and said, "What am I going to do?" And if I just push it away, then I'm creating conflict with this senior person, but if I go into the drug enforcement agency, then it's really going to be it's really problematic. Everything is—it's all dirty money in there. And I said, "It's not a problem. Go ahead and go into the drug enforcement unit, and just keep your precepts. Be really, and you know how to do that. That's what you do all the time. Just keep your precepts, and they'll transfer you out of there real quick." And they did. It was just a pain in the neck to have around. It was an embarrassment. So there are ways, and you realize, the precepts and right livelihood actually protect you and look after you. But it isn't as if you're going to really ever find the perfect. Place, livelihood. I mean, even as a, I would say as a monk, I mean, there's still things that you've got to be contemplating. Well, how do you do? How do you deal with it? How do you work with it?
Just because you're operating, even as a monk, we're still operating in society.
Even though
we have what one could conceivably phrase a pretty good right livelihood.
Yes.
You're still interacting and you're facing a lot of different kinds of moral dilemmas and choices.
Making choices.
One side that I had when I was working with making decisions about career choices, that I noticed that I really wanted, I really felt this desire to help the world, but I investigated that and I saw that there were sort of, I saw that for myself, the motivation was coming from this sense of wrongness, that somehow, there was something wrong, and, you can say it's wrong in here or wrong out there, but so long as there's this sense of something's wrong, I've got to fix it, there's going to be stress, and I realized that that's not the motive I want to act on. Whereas I think it's very important to recognize that there are other people who have this, you know, there is some group of people that they feel great compassion for. There is this sense of, these are people, you know, these are people, they're suffering, I want to help. And that's a very different motivation than saying, the world's a mess, I've got to fix it. And so I think that's a very useful question to investigate when you're thinking about right livelihood, because once I realized where my motivation was, maybe it's more important to investigate what's going on in my mind than I really make a pain of myself trying to fix the world.
Well, I think one of the, you know, in terms of stagnation, you again sort of looking at the cultivation of wholesome qualities. So you always want to be trying to motivate yourself to be, yeah, to be more skillful, to be more reflective, to be more sensitive, to be more effective, to be more useful, so that there's that kind of motivation is really helpful for encouraging oneself. There's a the Buddha pointed to two qualities that were most effective for his own enlightenment, which are, I think is an interesting reflection, in the sense that the one was the willingness to put forth effort, and the other was the willingness to not be content with the things that he's achieved or gained. So that, I mean, there's, on the one hand, there is emphasis on contentment as a virtue with the situations and things you've got, but then on another level there's a need to not stagnate in contentment and to put forth effort and to also be willing to not just rest on one's laurels or rest with, oh, it's good enough. There's a in Australia, they've got a saying that's probably every culture has a saying that is a source of irritation and frustration. Is near enough is good enough. Near enough is good enough, and then which means, but basically, you don't have to put much effort in for anything. So that there is that tendency, and then for the Buddha saying, yeah, not to be content with just near enough is good enough. Be willing to invest in that sense of that there needs to be some kind of motivation and striving, and you know, we can make ourselves neurotic with that as well. It's an important quality because the Buddha isn't pointing to an ultimate contentment and stagnation and nothing happening. You don't need to do anything. And that's actually, say in Thailand, there was a time when the government actually was trying to forbid the monks for teaching contentment. Making it illegal to teach contentment.
What comes back to, you know, musical instrument analogy, you know, like the lute, not too tight, not too loose.
Yeah.
There's a point where it's right in tune.
Yeah, and I think that recollection of when we're thinking of the right and wrong factors of the Eightfold Path, that these aren't just, you know, these aren't absolute black and whites. These are how does it tune into, how do you dial into that harmonizing of these different factors, so that they're effective in increasing the wholesome and decreasing the unwholesome in one's life.
I've been on the lute analogy, and the whole kind of being in tune. I know, you know, from watching musicians, like, even if you're in tune, eventually it like slowly creeps out of tune, and you have to retune.
So it's kind of like
a lifelong effort.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I mean, maybe at some point, if you're a Buddha or whatever, you get there and you're permanently in tune. But for most of us, it's like you're still.
Well, the reason why one's permanently in tune is because one understands how to be adjusting all the time.
All the time, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And to continue the musical analogy, I'm not much about music, but there are different keys to tune into. So. Like, as you were speaking about stagnation, I'm aware that in some occupations in this country, you could keep striving and striving and striving until you just drop dead of striving to improve.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's important to look at one's mind state and one's intention, and, you know, put work in perspective with other
factors. Yeah.
I just wanted to add on the sort of the Buddha's the idea of like continuously adjusting something. Like, I was thinking about how the Buddha, he got enlightened very early on, and then he developed his skills much further. It wasn't like he was done with maybe suffering, but like the spectrum for developing skillfulness interpersonally, and how to, I mean, you learn how to run a huge organization, you learn how to teach.
Yes.
It wasn't like he knew all that stuff, right?
And then continually learning. And that's an interesting aspect of the, say, like in the Vinaya, the monk's discipline. The Buddha wouldn't lay down a rule until there was an occasion for that. It wasn't as if he said, all right, for the next 45 years you're going to do this. And he sort of let things sort of be for quite a long time until, you know, things started to go a bit pear-shaped and wonky. So then start laying down rules for that. So then some of those rules were really spot on. Some of the rules were too loose, and people were still finding loopholes, so the Buddha had to tighten them up. And sort of like, I can't believe he just did that. And then sometimes it was the rule that he laid down was too tight. It just made it impossible. So then the Buddha would have to revise it and give exceptions or loosen it up in some way, so that there was always this adjusting. Okay, well, I would say that was a fruitful Upasaka day. Maybe we could take the opportunity to dedicate the blessings coming from this day there are chanting books there if anybody doesn't know them, and it's on page
27.
Page 27. Okay. Now let us chant the verses of sharing and aspiration through the goodness that arises from my practice. May my spiritual teachers and guides of great virtue, my mother, my father, and my relatives, the sun and the moon, and all virtuous leaders of the world, may the highest gods and evil forces, celestial beings, guardian spirits of the earth, and the Lord of death, may those who are friendly, indifferent, or hostile, may all beings receive the blessings of my life. May they soon attain a threefold bliss and realize the deathless through the goodness that arises from my practice and through this act of sharing. May all desires and attachments quickly cease, and all harmful states of mind, until I realize Nibbana in every kind of birth. May I have an upright mind with mindfulness and wisdom, austerity and vigor. May the forces of delusion not take hold, nor weaken my resolve. The Buddha is my excellent refuge, unsurpassed is the protection of the Dhamma. The solitary Buddha is my noble lord, the Sangha is my supreme support. Through the supreme power of all these, may darkness and illusion be dispelled. Okay. Go peacefully.
Can we announce the next Vipassana day?
Certainly can.
The next day is June 16th, I believe. That weekend in June, either Saturday or Sunday, I think
it's on the website calendars.
It's on the website.
I think it's a Saturday, yeah.
It's a Saturday?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, June 16th.
And the topic is monastic ritual and ceremony. So that the monks do.
And it's the Pasaka renewal day.
It's the renewal day.
It's the renewal day, yeah.
I'm hoping it will be especially interesting because maybe we'll get a sneak peek into some of the monastic rituals and things that I've been living here for a long time and I still feel like, how do you guys do that? Forgiveness ceremony? Like,
yeah.
So maybe I'm going to advocate for maybe a show and tell. We'll see, but I'm hoping it will be, very interesting.
Well, yeah, because that's also, in terms of within a Buddhist culture, well, certainly the culture that I grew up in terms of as a monastic, really see how those monastic ceremonies and rituals that are laid down by the Buddha in the time of the Buddha have been used and applied within a society and what the values that it imparts within a cultural setting. I think it would be interesting. Also, before I forget, the May 4th, there's going to be a senior Thai monk coming, visiting here, Ajahn Tan. I expect he won't be here till late in the day, but we've scheduled an ordination for Evan to go become a Samanera, and Anthony to ordain as an Anagarika. And then that gives an occasion to ask the Ajahn Dhan to give a teaching. So
that's on Sunday.
That'll be on Sunday the 5th in the late afternoon, early evening. I'm not 100% sure yet. And then he'll be here through till the 10th, which is the day. The day before that is the lunar observance day. So we'll be inviting Ajahn Dhan to give a talk that evening, and then he'll be leaving the next day. And he's a special monk, good monk, very good monk.